This meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Well, thank you again, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the RPM subteam for URF documents call on Wednesday, the 28th of February, 2018. Attendance for today's call will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge at this time, could you please let yourself be known now? Okay, great. Well, hearing your names, I would like to remind all. Oh, was that a name?
Yeah, Rebecca Tushnet.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Rebecca. All right. I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid background noise. And with this, I'll turn it back over to J. Scott Evans. Please begin.
Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Or good morning, depending on your particular location. This is J. Scott Evans for the record. Again, we're going to continue our discussions with regards to the URF and the best place to find data with regards to the issues that we're considering. I think we made it through several of the high level topics last week with suggested areas where we would find a data that might be helpful to the group. And I think if you look here in the screen on the Adobe Connect, you'll see that I think staff, which they circulated earlier, has gone to the main document in part two, and they have added a column in red line that contains the suggested data sources that we identified in our call last week. That would be in the far right-hand column. And this document is untethered, so you can scroll at your leisure through the particular document and see those additions from staff. I think our hope with this call today was to look over quickly the areas where we have talked about possible data sources and then move on once we feel like we have some agreement around those data sources and consider the remaining high-level topics to get possible sources of data with regards to those points, those inquiries. So that's how I hope that we will proceed. I did have one question because, and I just want to get an understanding from staff and the group. I note that there were two additional documents that were attached to the email with the agenda. One was a list of areas where we thought the providers could provide insight and would be a good source of data. And the second was a list that we felt like the practitioner group that is being asked questions, identified and asked questions, would be a good source of data. But I did notice that staff had indicated that we need to refine those questions ourselves. I wasn't sure if that is the purpose, if that's what how we want to proceed, or was our purpose just to identify and turn these over to the groups that are developing questions and allow them to develop the necessary questions with regards to those two groups. So I'd be happy to hear staff and their rationale for why they made that recommendation. That will add an additional layer to our work. So if someone from staff could let us know what they think about that, or if we, do people in this group believe that's what we want to do? Do we want to fashion those questions ourselves and send them over to the group, or do we just want to send the topics over and allow them to fashion questions? I don't want us to, I did share our high-level summary with the two co-chairs that are chairing the other two groups, so they are aware of our work. So I'd like to hear from others really quick on that specific point, and then we'll move into our review.
Jay Scott, this is Mary from staff.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mary.
So thank you. So I'll start, and I might hand off to Barry, because my apologies that I was not able to support the first half of the call last week due to a conflict. So I'll just explain those two additional documents. Essentially, we extracted what is in this new fifth column into two documents, as you noted, one with the questions for the practitioner team and the other with questions for the provider team. The thought is that when we send them over to both teams, it would be easier for them to see and to do the work required if it was clearly called out. Of course, we will also send this consolidated document as well. So what is in those two new documents really doesn't change anything from this one. It simply separates out the practitioner section and the provider section. And this team can choose not to use that, obviously, but to continue with the table as we've been doing. It was just something we prepared, sort of looking ahead for when we do send things to the other two teams. Then on the question you asked about further refinement, I think that actually is a question from the staff side. I see Barry's got his hand up, because we could certainly send the text as is to the practitioner and provider subteam. There were a couple of points in this new fifth column, as you'll have seen, where as the staff went back through the recording, we weren't 100% sure if that was all there was going to be or if this subteam wanted to do some further refinement. So that's what I understand the situation to be with respect to your question about refinement, but maybe I'll let Barry step in here and see if I got it right.
Thank you, Mary. Barry Cobb for the record. Yes, you did get it right, Mary. And, the in brackets need to further develop these questions is maybe a little, I guess, don't read it literally. But both of the other subs aren't necessarily working from this document. Either the providers are looking at the rules and procedures document. They're not really focused on the URS discussion document, and the practitioners, at least to this point, are developing a list and corralling the different various types of practitioners, and I haven't been following it closely, but I believe that they're also developing certain types of questions that they think they need to be asking the practitioners. So mostly the reason why I included it in brackets was kind of creative license on my part is I felt that the very least we need to develop some context around what it is that we're going to be sending to them instead of just giving them just this particular row, a develop questions on standing and grounds and filing period. Whether the group decides whether we need to do some of the heavy lifting for them or not needs to be understood, but I think we need to develop the context a little bit better so that they'll understand where this group is coming from and why we're not, why the documents group is not working on that in greater detail. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Okay. Now, let's go through this real quick and look at the data sources. I know that there has been some discussion between Brian and Rebecca with regard to a particular data point that we can discuss when we get to it, but I want to look at this, and feel free to disagree or say, but I thought we would go through quickly the data sources we've identified so far and make sure we've got agreement on whether these are the right data sources that we want to recognize. So for the complaint, which is A, you see here we've got three sources of data. With regard to the administrative review, we talked about We thought the providers was the best source of data or a good source of data. Then there was some discussion about, well, what type of marks are being submitted in the complaint? And there was a suggestion that we ask the practitioners about what they see with regards to this particular issue. And I see that we've got standing and filing periods need to gather, develop these questions, but I see that practitioners, as it relates to what they see in regards to standing, grounds, filing period. And I think this is some of the discussion that Brian and Rebecca were having, so I'll call upon them to raise their issues here as we proceed through. But, and I also note that Barry has said that, I think it was Barry's suggestion, in fact, that Rebecca's research might be another source of data with regards to some of these issues. I guess we'll have to know that when we actually look at what her research is, determine if that's...
Jay Scott, this is Brian. I'm on the phone only. I'm sorry.
You're on the phone only? Okay. So, anyway, Brian, do you want to go ahead?
In the email exchange with Rebecca and myself, but just one idea to throw out there is, what if, as a start, we looked at the decisions themselves to see, are they listing the marks? And obviously, the fact that the mark is listed in the decision tells us that it's...
Brian, I keep losing you. Comment we heard was if the mark was listed in the decision, and I got static and lost you.
Is that any better?
That's better now. I can hear you.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd throw this out there. If we look at the decisions quickly, see if the marks are listed, then that tells us it was listed in the complaint. If we do a quick pass through that and find we have good data, then we get good data. If we don't, then we maybe can do a deeper dive along the lines Rebecca suggested of asking practitioners for their experiences. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay. my query is, what set of, did we look at all the 827 cases to try to, or 867 cases to see, or do we look at some subset of that to see what the... I'm sorry, Rebecca, you are also on audio only. I apologize. Go ahead.
We are coding that. So it's just, it's coded in the data set. It's not going to be hard to pull out the column. It's just, is the trademark mentioned? What is it? I certainly hope that, people are entirely free to obviously go to the underlying decisions, which will also be linked, and double check, but it seems to me to be reasonably easy once we're through, hopefully pretty soon, to look at that. So I guess if you want to, it'll be there. I don't know. I'm happy to ask the practitioners. I'm not sure I would characterize it as my suggestion. I just wanted to make the point that, in fact, it's looking at the decisions that is the only way we get to look at the universe. Thank you.
Thank you. Barry?
Thank you, Jay Scott, and I'm glad Rebecca intervened, because that was pretty much what I was going to say is, they are reviewing through the 827 cases. I guess, in this section we can look at it as qualitative versus quantitative, quasi-qualitative data. So the qualitative, and I know that Rebecca likes us to be careful with this, is that, as I understood it listening through the recording, is that passing this over to the practitioners was to, give us your general sense of what is it that you've seen across the cases that you've dealt with as it relates to the marks being identified or presented as the evidence within the case. And then secondarily, the quantitative part, as Rebecca mentioned, the way that they're coding it and trends that can be rolled up when we're looking at the macro view of all 827 cases, hypothetically, and I'm not trying to predetermine the outcome of the research, but hypothetically, we could say that, well, 80% of the 827 cases did in fact list the trademark with its from this jurisdiction, et cetera, and then that there's a qualitative component that they're also coding in. So I think both of those sources of data, both qualitative and quantitative, can help try to answer some of the or help understand the issues identified here across the standing and grounds and those two areas. Thank you.
Okay. So are we comfortable with these two data points as sources of data? Is there anyone that wants to speak to that? Barry, is that your new hand?
Yes, sir. Just real quick. And so, again, you know, under the second bullet of the qualitative experiences from the practitioners, I just think it would be helpful if we, you know, there's an example listed there that, you know, we need more detail and guidance as it were to standing to file and whether we should expand the standing to allow marks. This part of the text, I think, was some, stated from somebody on the recording, you know, whether we should allow marks that were abusively registered or but are not confusingly similar. So I think it would be helpful when we pass this over to the practitioners group, for an example, that we try to put some more substance around exactly what it is that we're asking them other than just these two quick bullet points. My suggestion, anyway.
Okay. Any other thoughts or concerns? David.
Thanks, Jay Scott. It's David McCauley speaking for the record, and I will qualify my remarks by noting that I am not a URS expert by any stretch, but as I participate in this group, I just like to second a little bit of what Barry just said. As we look for data, I think we have to be very, very careful with qualitative things. Especially abusive registrations, because obviously there's a lot of room to argue there whether a registration was abusive or not. Depends on, I guess, from your vantage point, the way you're looking at it. But it seems to me that if we ever did get to the point of looking at abusive registrations, we would want to mark them in time by saying no registration that preceded a complainant's mark could be abusive with respect to that complainant's mark. In other words, if it was early in time, how could it be abusive with respect to any particular mark? And then, secondly, I would simply like to say on some of the requests to practitioners, it might be. I mean, if I were going to go to practitioners and ask questions, I would first focus on those practitioners who typically represent respondents. I would guess that practitioners that represent complainants would say that their complaints are all fine and dandy and fit every nook and cranny of the requirements, but that those who are defending cases may have a better eye out for what might be a problem with complaints. Thank you.
Okay. So are there any concerns about what we've listed here as sources of data?
Jay Scott, this is Brian. Could I follow up on that?
Sure.
Just one thought is, in terms of David's comment, I think kind of trying to tie together what I've heard and my suggestion, what I was thinking was we could, let's say, more objectively look at the data. What are the marks listed in the cases that helps inform us whether they're listed in the complaints? Then we can turn over to the practitioners group the more, I dare say the word, subjective look at, you know, are there design marks that they feel shouldn't have been in the clearinghouse, et cetera. But just one thought is on something David said was, I think it's only fair that we get a kind of a representative cross-section of, you know, complainant and respondent. Because it's, you know, look, if there are marks that are getting in the clearinghouse that shouldn't, and those are being used to file URS cases, that's worth looking at. But I think we shouldn't, you know, assume that all of the marks that are being invoked for U.S. or cases are bad. So it's only fair that we have a kind of a whole holistic picture.
Thanks. Right. And I would suggest that, you know, any questions that are asked to the providers group would be asked, to the practitioners group would be asked to the full group. It wouldn't be any way segmented into certain groups. I understand David's position, but I think it's best if we don't do that kind of filtering so that we make sure that we're getting, as best we can, the most balanced responses that we can get. So that would be, that's me speaking as, is there anyone that is in disagreement, violent disagreement with the fact that any questions asked to either of the lists, either of the groups, providers or practitioners, would be asked to everyone that makes up that particular segment. We wouldn't create sub-segments like only respondents' attorneys or only URS providers in the United States or, you know, that kind of thing. Okay. So let's move on quickly because we've got to move. Maybe the better way to do this is rather than going through all of these point by point, is asking, are there any points that anyone wants to make with regards to identified sources of data that we've identified here that they feel like either are inappropriate or need to be amended or clarified? And if so, what those objections, amendments, clarifications, revisions might be. So is silence meaning that everyone is comfortable with our work from last week and we can move on? David.
J. Scott, hi. It's David McCauley again for the record. Looking at the consolidated document, I don't have a comment so much as I have a process question, and that is what, if anything, is our responsibility as a sub-team to deal with issues like reviewing 58 particular cases or drafting an examiner's guidebook, those kinds of things? I mean, I don't have any objection to doing that. I'm just wondering, is that within our purview in the sub-team? And so these are sort of the non-data points that are raised in that document, non-data seeking points raised in that document. So it's a process question. Thank you.
Yes. It was my thought, and I believe Mary or Julie can correct me if I'm incorrect, but when we talked about this at the chair's call, our thought was that we would invite these sub-teams to continue with the substantive work and also open it up for others to join the sub-team to help with the substantive work. We certainly don't want to make people feel like they can't get involved if they didn't want to be involved in identifying the data, but they do want to be involved in reviewing the data and considering the data. So that was sort of where I think we came out. I think Mary's got her hand up too.
Thanks, David and J. Scott. This is Mary from staff. And J. Scott, I believe your recollection is correct. So while the sub-teams initially 2 weeks ago was formed to try and identify data sources, the chairs felt that it makes sense for the teams to go ahead and, of course, open their membership to others who might wish to join in the next phase of work. So the only other thing I wanted to add, J. Scott, is that under Agenda Item 4, Next Steps, that in terms of reporting back to the full working group, that this be something that this sub-team also report back on, as in, for example, if you are willing and available to continue with the work, such as reviewing the cases as need be or developing further guidance, et cetera.
Okay. Great. All right. So, shall we move on, or does anyone have any comments with regards to the data sources that we have identified so far? Okay, I think we left off at H, which is after appeals and it has to do with potential overlap concerning duration of respondent appeal. So, thoughts with regards to the best type of data for dealing with potential overlap? Yes, Brian. You're a little hard to hear, so if you'll speak up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I tried to make this suggestion on the last call. I'm sorry if it got overlooked, but I was wondering if we couldn't look at, because I believe there have only been a handful of appeals, we look at what different types they were and when they were involved, and that might help us look at, have an informed assessment of the utility of the different types of appeals. Thanks.
Okay. So, I mean, it looks to me like with regards to appeals, we have 14 cases, so we could look at somebody has a lot of static, and we could look at that particular group of cases to see if any of those, what the grounds for appeal were, if any of those were tied to notice or, outside one period or inside another period, what the timing of those were. That's one potential source, I think, for that. And then I think we could also look, and I'm not sure if Rebecca is coding for this, but, we can do, Rebecca, are you looking at, are you coding to see how many cases requested an extended reply period?
This is Rebecca. Yes, I mean, I don't have the document in front of me, but we should have data on when the replies were filed. And that I know for sure is coded. I don't know if we're coding requests separately.
Okay. But it seems to me that we might be able to tell just by the timing. If we have if it's filed 2 months after the notice was sent or after the complaint was filed, that might be something. So does anyone else have any suggestions for potential sources of data with regards to these, because we need to identify something. Now, again, as I said on the call last week, there is no potential sources of data for this, may be the answer. Barry.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Just to build on what Rebecca had mentioned, I am looking at their coding sheet. So it is they're coding for first a response within the first 14 days. The second code, it would be a response within 6 months. And thirdly, there was a response extension. And so, again, trying to visualize the distribution chart that I presented to the group earlier in the week, of those 250 or so cases where there was some sort of response, that kind of criteria should be fleshed out of that from Rebecca's research from her RAs.
Okay, thank you, Barry. Does anybody have any comments about whether that's a good data source or not, or if there's a better data source? I feel like a committee of one today. Let's move to the cost allocation model. Any thoughts of possible data sources to look at with regards to considering questions around this? John.
Hi, John McElwain for the record. I think for this we might want to refer to the practitioners group and maybe ask them, you know, what in their experience, what is the average cost to prosecute and defend a URS proceeding, although we could probably easily get it. The providers group could provide us the filing fees and maybe even a total of all filing fees that they've received. I think both those data sets can go both towards helping this group analyze whether the allocation model is appropriate and then what sort of impact there may be if there was a loser pays system. In other words, if you had to pay for all of the costs and fees, what might a loser be looking at? I guess lastly, we might have some of this data as well from the INTA study. We should take a look at that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, John. Any other thoughts? Okay. All right. I'm going to move on to language. So this has to do with language uses, including requirements for the complaint, notice of the complaint, response, and determination. So it seems to me that the policy itself, what it requires, and then perhaps, I don't know, the providers and how they send out the notice, but I think we've determined that everything is, I mean, in English after that, so somebody speak up if I have never done a URS, so I'm not familiar with the process itself. I'm happy for someone to give us some indication of where they think a good data source for trying to identify this information would be. Perhaps, again, it's the practitioners with to ask them what language issues they've encountered in dealing with these. I see we have a plethora of hands, so I'm going to call on Renee from the forum first.
Hi, Renee Fossil for the record. I can tell you that we as a provider provide ICANN on a monthly basis the different languages that we've used for that period of time. So that's a starting point, just to know how many languages are out there for, we do have data on that, I guess is what I'm trying to say. For whatever time period you're looking at, we can tell you how many different languages that we've sent out notices in. It's helpful to the group.
Thank you, Renee. I think that's a good source of data would be the ICANN reports, you know, for the period of time of the, until, you know, from when it, inception till today, you know, or something like that. John McElwain?
Thanks, Jay Scott. John McElwain for the record. I was going to say something fairly similar, that I would think that the providers would have a good feel for any language issues. I was actually surprised to hear that there might even be some data on this, and might ask Renee to come back on and find out whether she was referring to UDRP proceedings or URS proceedings. But if it's URS, I think that we've found our source.
Hi, Renee, for the record, I'll just pop back on and say yes, it's for URS specifically, the data set that I have.
Okay, but some of these issues that we're talking about may be broader than just the notice, right? If the notice goes out in a certain language, that the complaint is still in English, generally, correct?
This is Renee again. Yes, that is correct.
So as David points out in the chat, it may be that the practitioners are best to ask what problems, if any, they have encountered with regards to language during the prosecution or defense of a URS. Is John McElwain, is that a new hand? And then I'll go to the back.
Jay Scott, just to sort of to keep this going, I don't disagree that the practitioners might be able to provide some sort of anecdotal information, but I'm just not sure whether there's any data other than that a person is not understanding a language or is not fluent in a language that could be obtained from practitioners. It seems to me to be highly suspect, and in that a person is going to claim that they didn't understand a language, most likely. I think what we probably have to look at is just hard numbers here of the amounts of different languages that come in. I just don't see how we could get any real useful data from practitioners on this one. Thanks.
Okay. That is completely understandable. Would the providers also be I'll put this to the group. Let me go to Zach first because I'm tending to dominate. I apologize. Zach?
Thanks, Jay Scott. I'm only participating because you felt that you're a committee of one, so I'm going to try to put my two cents in. I wanted to ask Renee if she could just explain the landscape a bit more to us in terms of there's an obligation to send out the notice in English only or more than one language, or do we have the similar situation with the UDRP where it's the language of the registration agreement that the complaint is brought under, absent exceptional circumstances? So I wanted clarification from Renee, if possible, on that. And the second aspect is that from my sense is that some respondents who get notified of URS complaints might send an email to the provider saying, you know, I don't speak English or I don't understand or something like that. If that happens, maybe that would be interesting to note. And if it doesn't happen, that could also be interesting.
Renee? Hi. Yeah, okay.
I'll respond to Zach. The language of the proceedings is actually, we follow the rule, which is Rule 9. So the complaint comes in English. The response may be provided. So we send out the notice in whatever language of the registrant. The response either comes in English or the language used for the notice of complaint. And then the examiner that's appointed will be fluent in English and the language of the response. And then the examiner will determine which language to proceed in the examiner's discretion. And if there is no response, then it just proceeds in English. So as far as translating, we as a provider are only responsible to translate the notice of the complaint. And then the examiner may require the complainant to translate additional documents moving forward if there is any additional information that the examiner may need. So I hope that answers your first part of your question, Zach. And now I apologize, but I've forgotten your second question.
I'll just pop in to remind Renee. I think the second part of the question was whether the URS providers may be getting emails from response who've been notified with the URS proceeding that they have some problems with the language or they have difficulties responding. If I could just impose upon you one more time, Renee, if you could just flesh out a little bit more of the way Rule 9 works in practice. So I see the complaint shall be submitted in English, and so that are you saying that you will then provide a notice that a complaint has been submitted in English in another language, and how do you identify that other language? And forgive me if I'm not familiar enough with the rules in practice. I've handled, I think, 2 URS cases. That might make me an expert, but I don't have the answers to these questions. Thank you.
Okay, so for your second question from the first time was if we get inquiries on whether or not inquiries on language from respondents saying, you know, I don't understand English or I don't know what this is. I don't think that we get them all that often. I would We definitely don't keep any data on that. We do keep any emails that we do get on a case, archive them. So, you know, potentially we could dig for that, but I don't know that we would be able to identify a single source for finding that out. As far as additional information on Rule 9, I think Hector Manoff has typed some things into the chat. He is a URS provider or US examiner for us and has indicated that he received some complaints and responses in Spanish, and then he issues a decision in Spanish as well as English. And at that point, as I said, we'll translate the notice of the complaint into the language of the registrant. And sometimes that's a difficult thing to figure out depending on where they're from, but we do as much research as we possibly can to narrow that down. It's sent out with the complaint, which is in English. If we get a response, we forward that to the examiner, and the examiner that's appointed to the case speaks English and the language of the registrant, and then it's up to the examiner to decide what to do with the case moving forward. So we'd probably need to speak with maybe there are some practitioners that are also examiners as far as when that cut is made. That's not something that we necessarily provide a lot of guidance on because it's very case-specific on what issues are out there. I hope that helps.
Zach, is that a new hand?
Yes, please. Well, thanks, Renee. That might give us some idea of something to look at. If NAF as a URS provider is having some uncertainties about identifying the language of the notice, maybe that's something that ought to be looked at to either alleviate that uncertainty by or provide better guidelines for how to identify what language to provide the notice in. And I'm also curious about the comp that Hector Ariel Manoff left in the chat room, that he indicated he received some complaints in Spanish. And so from Rule 9, it looks like complaints are supposed to be in English. So I'm wondering how that came about. Maybe he could explain whether it was translated into Spanish from an original English document.
Well, I think rather than getting into the weeds right here as chair, I'm going to say that what I've heard so far now is we feel like the providers are probably the best data source with regards to language and language issues and to understand what their procedures are for dealing with language. And then we can identify when we understand those procedures if we see that there are perceived gaps in that. And if so, how to rectify those gaps. Would that be, because what we're trying to identify is the data source. And it seems to me that a good data source for this is going to be the providers, and it looks like that's the best data source at this point. Do we have agreement there? I see Zach seems to agree that that's the best. John McElwain, I think that's just the best thing to do is to get start there and find out what they're doing and where they have, asked where they have seen sticking points and problems to understand that particular issue better. And so for language, I'm going to suggest that we, unless I see huge disagreement, that we agree that the providers are the best source of information for data.
Yes, Scott, this is Brian. Can I make a quick comment?
Sure, Brian.
No disagreement. I just wanted to make a practical point, if it's helpful. I don't know the URS by heart. I imagine it might mirror the UDRP in this respect, in that with regard to the language, at least in the UDRP, it's not necessarily the language of the registrant, but it's the language of the registration agreement. So I guess it presupposes that if they've signed a contract in a particular language, then they're versant in that. And that, at least in the UDRP context, we get confirmation from by the registrar. So I guess it's just to say that shouldn't really require a lot of effort on the provider's part. It should be very black and white coming from the registrar in terms of which the registrant is signed up to. Thanks.
Yeah, and I have to call on Renee to answer that question. I don't know, but from her description, it seems that it is not tied to the language of the registry agreement. So
it's the predominant language of the registrant, the physical location of the registrant, not the
Yeah, so let me just give an example so I can make sure that we're all on the same page. If my name is, I'm Ricky Ricardo, and I live in Mexico City, but I own Adobe.com, which is a registration that I purchased through GoDaddy from VeriSign. So the registry agreement, all the registrar information is in English. When you get a complaint, you're going to look at who the Who Has Information says, and you see that I'm in Mexico City, you're going to send out a notice in Spanish.
Correct.
If my name is John Smith, and I live in Portsmouth, England, same fact scenario. Or let's say it's not. I'm in John Smith. I own a registration for a TLD that is in located in Asia, in Korea, for instance, and I used a French registrar. You're going to send it in English because John Smith lives in Portsmouth, England, correct?
Correct. And I think Mary typed something in the chat, which is helpful, too. She actually was able to quote from the rules.
Okay. So there you go. There's our answer. And that's a big distinction between the URS and the UDRP. The UDRP is tied to, so that's something that might be considered. Okay, so do we all agree that the providers are our best source of data with regards to language? Okay, Zach, do you have your hand up? Okay, so I'm not seeing any protestations or complaints or large red arrows coming out, so we're going to move on. So it's to abusive process. So I asked the group with regards to this, what do we think the best source of data is for the abusive process, misuse of the process, repeat offenders, forum shopping, any thoughts? Zach?
Sure, just two quick thoughts. Two sources of data. So one, in terms of whether abusive process is actually considered in a decision under rule, I forget the rule. But in any event, whether it's actually considered in the decision, that's something that can be identified by looking at the decisions. The second source of data is to ask practitioners for anecdotal or other evidence of such abuses of the process from their review of the decision.
Okay. This is Jay Scott. I'm just throwing this out there because it's been raised several times. In an effort to be objective, would it not be the best two sources of data would be decisions where the respondent has succeeded and the complaint was denied and any appeals? Because it seems to me that if a complainant succeeds, there's not been a determination that they abused the process in any way. As opposed to getting a subjective opinion from a practitioner looking at the cases to see has that forward? Was it considered? Because it seems to me that it would be the pool of cases where a respondent was successful and the pool of cases where there's appeal, because they may have been unsuccessful, but on appeal brought that claim that it was abusive. But I just throw that out there as a way to try to stay with just hard data of what we can see from the cases as they've been presented today. Zach, I see your hand is up.
Could I get in the queue?
Yes,
I'm putting Brian in the queue after that.
Sure. I agree with that. I happen to have looked at the 58 cases where the complaint was denied, and I didn't see any indications of abuse of the case. But there's going to be very little data, but the question is proper, and the bucket is proper to look at that. The other aspect is whether it was even considered, and you could look at those 58 cases to see if it was even considered in those denials.
Brian Beckham?
Thanks. I guess I just wanted to say I'm not sure I agree with the notion of if the respondent prevails that we should be looking at that for abuse of process. And one example that comes to mind, and I'm sure there are examples to support this, and people could probably point to counter examples, but I remember one of the early cases that was denied was Virgin.something. And I believe it was denied because of a lack of evidence tying the complainant to the actual trademark owner. So it was filed, I don't remember the exact facts, but by maybe a licensee that didn't have rights to bring standing under the URS. So I would not by any means call that an abusive process. It's just somebody kind of, mixing up a technical requirement that gets them across the finish line. I agree with you, J. Scott, looking at the cases where there is actually an abuse recorded and possibly even the appeals, but I'm not sure it's right to just look at cases where there's a denial, because a denial doesn't necessarily mean an abusive process. Thanks.
Okay. Let me be very clear here, because this is where we get off the rails. What I was saying, that a good source of data are the 58 respondent cases where they've prevailed and the 14 cases of that were appealed. Not to assume that just because a respondent won, that is somehow indicative that there was abuse of process. I'm saying to look at that data and then in that data pool to see if the reason for the denial was that this was abusive, that there was no connection to the trademark, and they actually say this is reverse domain hijacking, or this is an abuse of the process. Not, you didn't make your case. So that's what I was talking about, is we would ask specific questions. It's just that we would look at the 72 cases to see, because it seems to me it just follows logically that if there's been that finding, it's going to be in one of those situations, or if it's been raised it on appeal after there's been a finding, that's where you would find that information. Not that the fact that there was a respondent who was successful is indicative that there must have been abusive process, because the examiner pointed out that they didn't have enough evidence, or they didn't make a case that satisfied the fact. I would be looking for, specific abusive process determination. Or I think that I say I would. I think we should. John McElwain.
Hey, John McElwain for the record. Jay Talk, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks like we figured it out on the list. So there is a database where a finding of abuse has been made by a panelist that is publicly accessible, et cetera. So I think Renee said there's no cases in it, but at least in terms of a complaint being brought in bad faith, that is, pursuant to the rule, supposed to be determined by the panelist and then reported within one business day to a electronically accessible database that all providers can access. So I think we got our source here. Thanks.
There you go. That seems to me to be the best source of data. If we've got a procedure to look at whether that's taken place, it seems to me we have, a place to look at. Now, I would ask Renee, I noticed that Mary says that they're supposed to make if they make that determination, the decision, they're supposed to justify it. Does that also go in that list, or would that only be in the decision? In other words, is everything captured in that list when there's been an abuse of process determination, or is that only when someone looks at the complaint and makes that determination?
The determination is made by the examiner, and we have it set up so that we're alerted when that happens so that we know it's an electronic system that we have. So the examiner will make a finding of abuse if they do. They check a box, and then we're alerted and then would know to add it to the database, which we have never had to do. We've had one examiner check the box, but then I read the decision, circled back with her, and it was a mistake. So at least in my tenure here, I have not added anything to the database, but it should also be a specific paragraph in the decision setting forth that there was an abuse finding.
Okay. So it seems to me that this provider's process and list is our best source of data. Do we hear any objection to that? Back.
Yes. I don't have an objection to that per se, because I do think that is the best source of data as a starting point. I will just observe two aspects of it. One is that, as Renee alluded to, from a review of those 58 decisions, it doesn't look like there's consistency in the panels considering abusive process, but from the rules, nor does it look like they're required to necessarily. So, for example, under 13B, it says, if after considering the submissions, examiner finds that the complaint is brought in bad faith, it was brought primarily to harass the domain holder, the examiner shall declare. So, in other words, it's not obligatory that the examiner opine or make any finding on that. So, if the issue doesn't come up as far as the examiner is concerned, they don't even need to record it in the decision necessarily. So that might be an aspect that is ultimately looked at for revision of the URS. But in terms of where the data comes from, we wouldn't be able to get it. Once we see that there's no cases out of the 58 where there's been that declaration made, that leads to two other questions. One is, should there be a mandatory declaration? And two, were there absences where declarations should be made? And so those kinds of questions go to the practitioners, I would think. But in terms of a first step of getting the data, which could possibly lead to those additional questions, I agree that that bucket of 58 is the starting point. And the data that's obtained from the actual automated MAF system, for example, is just going to show us that there was zero such findings, but that's such a minimal and unhelpful level of analysis that we may want to go beyond that, but for the purposes of data gathering, that is the starting point. Thank you.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that, Zach, you're asking a lot of questions that would be asked after we look at the data. So if the answer is zero, then you're raising issues that I think don't point to data, they point to conclusions we might raise from the data and how we might address those conclusions, the data. So I think that given that fact that it looks to me that the abuse of process, there is a process We can have that explained to us from the providers. So the providers in this list and how that works seems to me the best data set for us to consider. And then we can look at those first 58 cases as well, or all, I guess, 72 if you add in the appeals, just to make sure that nothing was missed in those as another data point.
Okay. Could I react?
Sure.
I don't want to disagree for the sake of disagreeing or kind of take us backwards because this subgroup is making great progress. I'm just a little concerned that this suggestion from Zach, I think it's got merit, but it really reminds me of the discussions we had in the broader working group where there were concerns raised about second guessing the determination, and I think that this is going to be necessarily in the eye of the beholder. So, I don't want to impede progress. I just wanted to register that I'm concerned there may be disagreement once we kick this back to the broader working group for discussion. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the questions we ask with regards to that data, but again, as I've said, I think the proper question would be looking at these. Did the examiner in any way indicate there was an abusive process? And if the answer is there are zero reported, we looked at the 72 cases that we felt like where it may have been an issue and there were zero instances where it does, it looks like the system at least is working, nothing's been missed, and then we can, I'm not asking in any way, and I think it should be very clear, what the kind of information we're seeking is not to look at it and say, well, in my opinion, the examiner should have raised an abusive process because this is so clearly outside that's not the type of subject I think we can get into. I think we just look to see if anything's, we look at the list, it's zero. I think it's an extra step to go and say, then we looked at the cases that were respondent one, and we don't see any instances where that determination was made and it wasn't reported to the list. We looked at the appeals. It was never raised on appeal, or our determination was never made on appeal. We could say it was raised on appeal, but it was denied. I mean, I'm just trying to find the groups of data, and do we agree that those are two good pools of data that we consider? Okay. I see John McElwain has agreed. I see Paul has agreeing. So I'm going to say that those are two good pools of data. Now for education and training, are we ready to move? Is it okay if we move on? Can I see some indication that everyone's comfortable with that? Okay, I see a rabbit. I'm going to take that from John McElwain. Let's speed through the hare, tortoise and the hare. So education, responsibility for education and training of complainants, registrants, registries, and registrars. I'm going to postulate that I think the best sources of data for this are to look at the provider's website and see what information that they provide publicly, to look at ICANN's website to see what information it provides publicly, and to look at a select number of registrars' websites to see. I mean, those are the places I think we would look at and just see what information they are providing to date. The question of whose responsibility of it may be something that seems to be more conclusory when we look at this and we decide, well, it either is adequate or it isn't adequate, and if it isn't adequate, whose responsibility is it? But I would just say that those are some proposed objective data sets we could look at. If there's no information, then we need to ask a question. If there is information, you know, did we feel like it, as a group, it offered sufficient explanation? So does anyone agree or disagree with, will we look at that? That's what we should look at? Okay. Now, with regards to, I'm going to move on unless Zach raises the point, why not ask the providers what training and education they provide to parties, panelists, and the community? I think that is a probably, as Mary raised, it comes up in the next section. So they are tied together somewhat. So, but I do think that that is a question we might pass along to the providers, is to ask them that specific question, Zach. And that would help us with both L and M. Is there anyone who because my point with regards to section M is I'm not so sure if we need I mean it looks to me like the best source of data with regards to M is ICANN. Does anyone agree or disagree? For U.S. providers, evaluation of U.S. providers and their respective processes. It looks like the best source of data with regard to that is ICANN. And I would assume, given that that's sort of what the providers are focusing on, that they're going to be looking at that. But it seems to me that that's the best source, is to ask what, if anything, they do. Mary?
Thanks, Jay Scott. So just two minor follow-up points. In terms of evaluation of the providers, that may be something we can take back to the provider sub-team, because my understanding is that they are reviewing the memoranda of understanding that ICANN has with each of the providers. So that may be something to discuss with them as to what is done or whether anything is done on the evaluation side. Then with respect to the training side, to follow up on Zach's question as well, I think as we all know that the rules do provide that providers have to give that training. I'm not sure that ICANN has any kind of requirements or mandates or whether that is up to each provider. So it seems to me that on this point of training, it may be something to ask the providers themselves. Thank you.
Agreed. Any other thoughts or comments? So it looks like we have two, and with regards to N, as in Nancy, alternatives to the ERF, I personally don't think there is any data source for this. This seems to be completely a policy question that is probably the sum of the conclusions reached once reviewing all the data that comes before that particular question. But I am open to somebody telling me they disagree with me. In other words, I don't think there is any data that's going to tell us whether there's a possible alternative to the URS. I think that seems like a conclusion that comes from after considering all the data, if that's a recommendation we want to make based on the data we've drawn, the conclusions and recommendations we've drawn based on the data we've considered. But somebody debate with me here and tell me they think I'm crazy or it's just a policy question. I don't think that's a data-driven question at all. Okay. Okay. All right. We have got 15 minutes left, and I think we've done a good job of identifying data sources, our proposed recommended data sources to the larger group with regards to each of the topics. I do think that there probably is some additional work to be done with regards to contextualizing some of the things we've talked about. So I think the question would be, I'm sorry, John McElwain. I keep saying that
wrong. Hey, no worries, Jake. And this may be getting ahead, so I apologize, but I was wondering if any of the other sub-teams had referred any questions or issues to us.
No, and the reason for that, I think, is self-explanatory, because our group was to identify the best sources of data, is my understanding, correct? And they, on the other hand, are looking to certain groups to extract certain information rather than say there's a source of data. So I think that it's just very different purposes. Mary and the staff can update this document and get it ready for presentation. I think the question I have is I don't think there's time before San Juan to look at the things we say we're going to refer out to the providers and the practitioners and develop context around them sufficiently. I think what we could probably do is report and say we have a number of issues that we've decided, if we could send our final sort of grouping of issues we think that they would be appropriate for those groups. And then I think we could ask those groups, do they need additional information from us? Do they want questions from us that we could collaborate with them on that? And then the next group that would also look at the data, you know, the continuation of this subgroup would be to give that context and work to make sure that that gets to the providers. But I'm wondering if we just provide them with sort of a top-level view of what type of information we think that might be good coming from them, because they might say, yeah, we've got that covered. We're already looking into that. Mary, you're raising your hand.
Yes, thanks, Jay Scott. This is Mary from staff. So just looking ahead to the report and our expectation, based on the discussion, Jay Scott, that you've had the other chairs, is that one of these sessions, or more than one of the sessions upcoming in San Juan as early as next weekend, would be used for sub-team reports. So just thinking aloud here that, as you were saying, and staff will confirm that we will update this consolidated document. We can also clean up the, you know, separated practitioner and provider ones, write up maybe a short paragraph to describe what this sub-team did and, you know, how you went about doing the data source identification, so that as you present the update in San Juan, whether in person or remotely, I assume that you would be going through this document, but having some kind of written context to explain what the team did and how it did it may be helpful. So we can spend some time, Barry and I, thinking about how we can best organize it to make it easy and readable for you folks on this team as well as for the working group. But the final thing I'll ask is Jay Scott to, you know, confirm if you would like to do the update and also to remind members of the sub-team that if you haven't yet filled out the survey about whether you'll be attending the sessions in San Juan to please do so, so that even if Jay Scott is presenting, it'll be helpful to know which other members of the sub-team are going to be present at the session, whether remotely or physically. Thanks, Jay Scott.
Okay. So is everybody comfortable with that plan of action? Okay. If staff could circulate that within the next few days, then we could get, you know, a call for any comments with regards to the summary of what we did in case people feel like we need to do some additions or if there are any, you know, revisions that they feel need to be made to those particular things. Okay. Well, we made it through all of the points. And, of course, we realized these sub-teams, I just want to remind everyone, these are generally recommendations that are made to the full working group, and the full working group will have the ability to opine, comment, request revisions to any of the work we've done, to supplement the work we've done, and any sub-team member can, if they have concerns they've expressed here and felt like they weren't acted upon or weren't heard, can raise those again. I just want you all know that, you know, what we are doing is we're just breaking the work in small chunks for approval by the larger working group before there's actually action taken on everything. So I just want to make sure people are pretty comfortable with that, that these are mere recommendations and they are not in any way set in stone or a fait accompli as to the rest of the members of the full working group who may not have had the time nor the inclination to participate in this small working group. Okay? Any comments, concerns, additional points anyone wants to raise? You've got 6 minutes to do so. Hearing none, I'm going to let everyone have six additional minutes to their day. I can hear the joy coming off the Adobe Connect as we speak. The CI, I'm applauding. So thank you all very much for your time. I really appreciate everyone's hard work. Thank you to everyone that participated both in chat and on the telephone line. Thank you to staff for all your hard work in summarizing and keeping us on task. I really appreciate it. Everyone have a wonderful day and a good weekend if I don't speak to you before. Thanks so very much. Ciao.
Thank you very much, Jay Scott and everybody, and safe travels to those who will be joining us in San Juan. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Today's meeting has been adjourned. You can disconnect online. Have a good rest of the day.